up here because I was scared that I might slip, and I don't wear underdrawers, so it had to be a real careful thing. This is the too much information. That's what my mother always told me, and I was like, what? This is the audience participation. Duh. Huh? T. Hi, y'all. My name is Dehalty. I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful to be sober and grateful to be here by God's grace. Wait one second. I have to write down what time I stopped talking. Okay. I am grateful to be here by God's grace. I've been reborn in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not the same woman, thank you, God, that I was when I got here. And my home group is the same home group that Chris and Dolores belong to. It's the Miracle Group in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. My sobriety day is January 1st, 1983, and I have a sponsor named Ann who has a sponsor. And I'm just so delighted to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and to be here. I love Louisiana. Tuesday, well, Mark and I, some of you know my husband, Mark, he's from Boston. Well, we met in Alcoholics Anonymous. He couldn't be here this weekend because we sold our house, and we live in Navarre, Florida. We sold our house, and last Thursday the movers came and took everything away. And the only reason we haven't moved yet is because I wanted to fulfill my commitment and come here to Louisiana. So when I go back today, tomorrow will be a holiday, and then Tuesday morning we're going to jump in the car with our two semi-feral cats, our two rescue parrots, and our rescue dog, and some plants and food and clothes, and head off. We're moving to New Mexico. So that'll be quite an adventure. We always call them the Mark and Dehalty Big Adventures, so it'll be another adventure. And last weekend, we were up in northern Louisiana. I'm not going to say where, but it was northern Louisiana, and the folks were really nice there. But there's nobody like southern Louisiana people. Nobody. They don't have any Cajuns there. There was no Cajun Joe there. And Mark and I kept talking. We're going, boy, it's so different here. It's not really like Louisiana. It's kind of like Texas or something. And we just missed the hospitality. I shouldn't say the hospitality. They were real hospitable, too, but it was totally different. Northern Louisiana is totally different. And we just love you southern Louisianians. We're going to really, really miss you, but we're going to come back and visit. I want to thank the committee, Mark and I and Chris and Dolores. We've both been on convention we have over in Fort Walton Beach. We have both been on the convention committee for several years, and it takes a lot of work, a real lot of work. For those of you who have never served on the committee, I suggest you do it. Get off your butts and go to that meeting and help out doing the convention. It gives you a whole different insight into what's going on. And Bob was just great. He bought all the speakers a present. He bought me this beautiful beaded pink flamingo, and it's going to sit on my fireplace in New Mexico. It was just great. I loved it. And then Julie and I had a great time talking. Did we talk at dinner? Sometime yesterday. It might have been dinner. And I just want you to know that Julie painted this. Isn't this beautiful? You know? This is the kind of stuff that didn't just magically appear, that, you know, the AA magical person made this appear. People do all this stuff and put it together for us. You know, here we are, down and out, mooch losers, and we get to be reborn in Alcoholics Anonymous and be useful, and we get together and have a good time. And that part that Susan read this morning, we're not a glum lot, and you people in South Louisiana know that. I don't know if you have any folks here, but I've run into a lot of folks in AA. They'll be like, yeah, I'm really grateful to be sober. Damn it. And it's like, well, why don't you tell your face and start acting like you're grateful, you know? It's not about being all serious and, we've got a few 24 hours. It's about being active in service and being useful to God and being useful to other people, not just acting, you know, all spiritual in the AA room and then go outside and talk ugly to somebody or kick somebody or do all that. It's about living the principles that we've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's just a wonderful, wonderful way of life. My mother has a picture of me. I don't take pictures of me. It's a it's against my spiritual nature. Oh, let me tell you a couple other things about myself. I'm Cherokee Indian. I'm from Tennessee. And if any of y'all in here are Indian, this is important for you to know. My clan is the Wild Potato Clan. And if you're not Indian, it doesn't mean anything to you. But if you are, we all tell each other that. So, you know, I needed to tell you that. So I don't really have many pictures taken, but my mom had a picture of me when I was 2 years old. And in the picture, I'm kind of smiling a little bit, not much. My mother said, "I just love that picture. That's the last time I saw you smile until you got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous." Now, is that testimony to what happens here? Oh, believe me, I laughed. When I was drunk, you know, I could laugh, you know, at ridiculous stuff. And if, you know, if you fell down, "Oh, look at that loser." And, you know, I could laugh, or I could laugh at bawdiness. I could be really bawdy. I know it's hard to believe, Bob, that I could be bawdy. But just that real deep gut laughing. When I first came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I came in, my first AA meeting was 1981, and I haven't drank since 1981, but that's not my sobriety date because I continue to do other things. So my sobriety is January 1st, 1983. But when I came in, one of the first things that struck me was that y'all were laughing. And first of all, of course, I thought you were laughing at me because you know how we are. If somebody's laughing, it has to be at my expense. And then I figured out that nobody was even looking at me, so they weren't laughing at me. And then I figured it maybe, you know, the coffee pot, somebody put something in it, you know, maybe it was Irish coffee or something that everybody was laughing. But I liked the laughter, and that kept me coming back, you know, time after time, that I would keep coming back to AA because the laughter, even though I was really down and out and I was just broken, the laughter was already starting to heal me a little bit. The speakers this weekend have been great. I loved hearing everybody. Now, I've got some serious brain damage, so my memory is about this big. So things that the speaker said, I was like, "Oh, I want to mention that. It was so good," but I've already forgotten it because I'm just, that's just the way I am. But I remember Chris. Chris is a member of my home group, and he's a guy that, I'm 59 years old, and Chris is 40. And Chris is like a son to Mark and I. We just love him. He's watching him come in and watching the changes in him and the things he's going through. He's just a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's real special to me to have him in his life. And I love his wife, Dolores, as well. Dolores has had a real struggle. She's, you know, still in a fight with God. But she's a wonderful woman. And I think that we all are. You know, we come here with our stories and our experiences and all that stuff. But a friend of mine, John Paul, is a Catholic priest, but he's also a member of AA. That just happens to be his job. And he's been sober quite a long, long, long time. And he says that I used to go to this women's retreat, and he would be the retreat master. It wasn't a Catholic retreat. It was just a retreat that the Catholic monastery was kind enough to let us have an AA retreat at. And he would be the retreat master for the women, and he would talk with me for hours and hours at night, and he said that he really believes to the bottom of his heart that alcoholism is a sacred illness, and that only a spiritual remedy will help with this sacred illness. He further went on to say that he thinks that, don't let any of this go to your head, folks, just remember the last time you peed in your pants. He thinks that that we are alcoholics, that we are fallen mystics, that we come into this world, into this life, and I know this is my story. I got here, I'm like, who are these beings? Where am I? What world is this? I didn't know how to relate. I just didn't know how to relate. So that's what John Patrick says, that we're fallen mystics, and we have a sacred illness, and we just push everybody away from us because our illness is so severe. And then we have to, if we're fortunate enough, if we're blessed enough to accept the spiritual help of Alcoholics Anonymous, we can be reborn. So let me tell you, the big book says in a general way, we tell what we used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I'm the oldest of seven children. There were four other children that didn't. My mother wasn't able to carry full term. I'm the only girl. I have six younger brothers. I didn't know I was a girl for a long time. Sometimes I still wonder. You know, I feel kind of weird. But anyways, I didn't know I was a girl for a long time. I have these six younger brothers. My father, bless his heart, he's passed, but he was an alcoholic. He was a functioning alcoholic. And he He was a lifer in the military. He Indian boy from Tennessee, and our men are very patriotic conscious and very willing to take their place as warriors. And I'd like to salute and thank all of you who are veterans. Thank you so very much for the sacrifice that you've made for all of us. Especially this weekend, we need to remember, you know, what this weekend is really about. It's not just about, you know, having barbecues and being at a nice AA thing. There's people having sacrifices made right today, you know, in the Gulf War, and we have so many others that have made so many sacrifices, and we need to remember them, and I do. Part of my amends process later on was I worked in a VA hospital for 5 years. Not the patients, but the other people that worked there. But that was part of my amends process to honor the veterans, and I did that. Well, anyways, I've got these six younger brothers. My dad's a lifer in the military. Here was Grinya boy that came out of the back hills of Tennessee, dirt poor. I'm talking dirt poor. My dad and his family grew up in a dirt floor shack with no windows or anything like that. My grandfather was a bad drunk, and he'd just go off and be drunk. And my grandma, he'd come home once a year and get my grandma pregnant, and so she had a bunch of children. And my grandmother hunted and grew food to feed her and her children. And it was poor living. They were poor. So my dad left there, and he joined at the time it was the Army, and then it became the Army Air Force. And he went into the military, and he didn't know how to read or anything like that. And so the children start coming along, and I was this little kid. I was a scared little kid. We always hung around. The military was very segregated back in those days. And my father was in a unit and hung around with other soldiers, either the black soldiers, the Indian soldiers, or the Mexican soldiers. We all always hung around with other people of color. And my father would drink, and he'd be drunk all the time, but he was a functional drunk, and he'd go to the Air Force every single day, and he would have his boots polished, and he'd look sharp, and he'd do his job. He was a firefighter. And I was a scared little kid. I was a broken child. I don't really know exactly what happened, but I was a broken little girl. I just didn't relate to other children. And it wasn't so much because my parents, my mother drank a lot, but she's not an alcoholic. She was a heavy drinker, and there's a big difference. And I don't know if I was broken because my father was an alcoholic, because everybody else's dad and mom were too. So it wasn't that. But I was a broken child, and I just felt like there was so much injustice in the world. I was a little girl, and the way that we were treated, and the way that our friends were treated, and there was so much hatred in the world, I just didn't understand. And I'm talking 4 or 5 years old. I saw this, and I felt it. I felt the pain of the world, and I didn't want to be here. And I think it goes back to what John Patrick talks about, of us being fallen mystics, because we're so sensitive. We're so overly sensitive. And I taught myself to read real young, and I fell into the world of literature, and I escaped through that. And my dad asked me one day if I would teach him how to read, but it had to be between us. I couldn't tell anybody. And I taught my dad to read very basic reading. I mean, he certainly didn't go into reading anything heavy, but basic reading. And he learned to be able to sign his name, and he learned to be able to read his orders and stuff like that. And I started feeling shame because I saw that other people's dads, moms could read, and that other people, their lives were just a little bit different than us. And I started feeling the shame. And my mother was a heavy drinker, and my father would get shipped somewhere, and my mother would go out drinking and partying at night, and I'd feel ashamed about that. So I started having all this shame stuff coming up. So when I was 9 years old, some stuff happened there that just stuff that happens to some children that shouldn't happen to them, and it happened frequently. And at 9 years old, I just had it, and I had my first suicide attempt. And it was obviously an unsuccessful attempt. So I decided that, well, that didn't work, so I was going to drink some of that stuff that my mom and dad drank and see if they seemed to drink it and, you know, have a good time at first before the things got ugly. So I took some turpinhydrate. That's GI gin. We were poor, and we'd go to the dispensary, and they'd give you this turpinhydrate for everything. They'd give you these pills called all-purpose capsules. I'm not making this up, okay? They give you all-purpose capsules. So I went in the bathroom and I took a few of these all-purpose capsules, which really did nothing. I brought in some airplane glue. My brothers and I would make model airplanes and stuff. I brought in some of that. I'd heard kids at school talk about it. I brought in some of my mother's cool cigarettes, and I put on one of her brassieres. Now, at 9 years old, I was not developed at all. I see some girls today that are. I was not developed at all. If I didn't have any clothes on, I had my hands in front of me, you'd think I was a boy. I was not developed. So I put on this bra, and I stuffed it with socks, and put my clothes on, and I'm standing in the mirror in the bathroom, and I'd never backsassed to my parents up to this point. I'm just a quiet, scared kid. And I'm in the bathroom, and I'm drinking this terpene hydrate, and I did some of that glue, and I'm smoking these cool cigarettes that like to kill me. I'm coughing and coughing, but after the third or fourth one, I kind of liked them. And then I did that terpene hydrate, which is a real lot of alcohol in it, and it went down to my stomach. Boom! I'll tell you what, I had a spiritual experience. I mean, it was fabulous. It was just fabulous. I just wasn't this skinny little kid anymore. The world, all right, whatever, the world's a bad place. Those babies were mine. I was a woman. I'm 9 years old. Nobody's going to boss me around anymore. I'm taking control of my life. And the change, it was like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, that change just came over me. We had a lot of people living in base housing in this little apartment, and there was one bathroom, and I've been in here quite a while now. So people are knocking on the bathroom, that, and on base housing, we didn't have outhouses, so, you know, there was one bathroom. So knocking on the door, hey, we've got to come in, what are you doing in there? And that was the first time I ever said something ugly to my mother. And I don't remember what I said, but I had never been a sassy child before, and I said something ugly to my mother, because I've got alcohol in me now, and hey, nobody's telling me what to do. And so I told my mother some ugly words and told her to leave me alone, and my mother was like, girl, when you come out of there, and I, you're paying. And I came out of the bathroom, and I had a look in my face that my mother didn't do anything, and she just sent me to my room. That's fine with me. And then I went out to the living room, and my father was reading the paper, and I said, I'd never called my father. My father didn't know our names. He knew us, but he never called us by name. It was girl, boy, 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 boy. You boy, you girl. So his name was Joe, and I went and I said, Joe, I want to talk to you. I'm 9 years old now, and I'm wearing a bra stuffed out to here. And I got some alcohol in me, and I'm reeking of cigarette smoke. And he's not looking up. He continues to read his paper. And I says, did you hear me? I want to talk to you. I got something to say. He'd probably never even heard me talk. He didn't even know whose voice it was. And he didn't answer me again. So I grabbed that newspaper and I ripped it in half. And I said, I wanted to talk to you. And my father looked up at me. And I'd never seen this happen before. But fire came out of his nose and out of his eyes. And I intuitively knew, uh-oh, something bad's going to happen. So we lived in third floor based housing, and my father got up, and I knew that I was in big trouble. So I ran out to the balcony, and I stood up on the railing. I had never behaved this way before. I was a frightened, scared little girl that obeyed everything and everybody. And now I'm standing up on the balcony. I was reading Wonder Woman and Superman at the time. Now I'm Wonder Woman. I'm standing up there, you know, all Wonder Woman. And my dad says, get off that balcony, girl. I'm going to whip your butt. And I said, if you come one step closer to me, I'm going to jump. And I know that if I jump, you're going to lose those two stripes that you have. So I'm learning some manipulation here. So I made him swear to God that he wasn't going to hit me or do anything to me, and that I'd come in. And he looked at me, he goes, girl, you're the craziest little I've ever met in my life. And I was in my head, that was the nicest thing anybody said to me, because it meant that they acknowledged my presence. I was acknowledged. I was alive. Somebody took note of something I did. And I made a decision right there and then that being a good girl was for the birds. I was going to be bad, and I was going to be the baddest girl in town. So at 9 years old, I learned that if I manipulate people and I act like a total psycho, people will do what I want. And so my dad didn't hit me, and he let me in, and I heard him and my mother talk, and he goes, we're going to have problems with that girl. We're going to have some real problems with that girl, and they did. So that was at 9 years old, and I wasn't able to drink a lot at that time because my mother and father didn't have a bar. They just drank their wine or their whiskey or whatever, and you know, there wasn't any left. But by 13, I found out that I could go to the town wino and give them my lunch money, my school lunch money. Now, my mom and dad worked hard. My dad went to the Air Force every day. My mother was a cocktail waitress. Sound familiar to any of you Al-Anoners? She was a cocktail waitress. And I wish my mother had gone into Al-Anon, but she never did. But they worked hard for their money and to give us lunch money. Once I started in junior high, I'd get lunch money because all the other kids had lunch money, and they, you know, they just wanted to do that for me. And I took my lunch money and gave it to the wino, and he bought me Colt 45. So by 15, I crossed over the line, and I was a full-blown alcoholic. By 15, I was dancing in the bars at night, and I was the girl in high school that you weren't allowed to hang around with. The boys wanted to hang around with me, but I was already seeing men, and the girls weren't allowed to hang around with me. I was that girl. No, you're not hanging out with that girl. That girl's bad news. I was a girl that called to the principal's office because I'd be half drunk every day in school, half drunk from the night before and half drunk from the pint that I had in my locker with me. So they tried some child psychology on me. They were going to give me a job and make me feel important and that maybe I'd, you know, act right. So the principal called me in and told me that he had heard there was girls smoking in the bathroom. It was me. I was the one smoking in the bathroom. And that he wanted me to be the bathroom monitor and, you know, take care of it so the girls wouldn't smoke in the bathroom. So I said, okay, and I went in the bathroom, and a couple girls were smoking, so I just beat the hell out of them and told them they couldn't smoke anymore. And he called me back to the office, and he said, no, that's not what we had in mind. They couldn't smoke in the bathroom. I could. As soon as I beat him up, I smoked. But he didn't want me to have them smoking. And so that's just the way my life went. You know, I'm dancing in the bars at night. I don't really remember high school at all. My father worked a job as a firefighter. He'd worked 3 days at the base as a firefighter and stay live in the barracks, and he'd come home for 3 days. And the 3 days that he was gone, it was just open season for me because my mother would be out working, and I could either get in before she got home. She usually got home about 2 in the morning, or she'd come home and have a few drinks after work and be half-tanked so she wouldn't know that I wasn't there anyway. So it worked. It was perfect for me. It was just perfect. And that's when I learned just how to be sneaky and how to be a psycho and how to manipulate people. And other people in school were making plans to go in the military or to get married or to go to college. And, you know, Chris talked about nobody said they wanted to grow up. You know, you hear counselors saying this. Nobody ever said they wanted to grow up to be an alcoholic. Well, I'm like Chris. I'm a total burnout like Chris. It was fine with me. You know, I didn't have any plans or aspirations other than doing what I was doing. And what I was doing was I started prostituting, at a pretty young age. It seemed like an okay thing to do. And for any of you gals who have done that, or if you haven't yet and you thought that it might be a good way, it's not like the movie Pretty Woman. Let me tell you that right now, okay? It's not like the movie show. It's ugly. It's really ugly. And the more you do stuff like that, the more I'd have to drink to not know what I had done. And the more I had to drink, the more I had to do that to get more money to drink. And it was pretty ugly. And it wasn't, you get these really cute guys and stuff. So I just want to tell you, it's not like that, okay? Just so you know that it was a real ugly life. But I was willing to pay that price to continue to drink the way that I drank. I moved to New York City when I was 18 because I didn't know what else to do. So I moved to New York City, never been there before. And I lived on the street. And what I did was, on 42nd Street, I could make a little money. I'd help make up the drag queens for their stroll up and down 42nd Street. They stroll one side of the street, and we'd stroll the other side of the street. And that's how I lived. I started being arrested all the time, brought in. It was against the law to be a prostitute, and it was against the law to be drunk in public. And so I was always brought into jail, and then the nut houses started. I'd be brought in 4-point restraint because when I get drunk, I get real angry. And when I get real angry, I get real angry at Christopher Columbus for coming here and stealing my country. And I get real mad at white people. I just hated all white people. And I hated Christopher Columbus. And I hated men. And I hated women. And I hated everybody, including me. I just hated everybody. So I'd get mad, and I'd just get so ugly. And I always carried a knife, or I'd carry a razor blade. have to cut you if I had to. And it was a real ugly life. So I started to be brought into the Nut House in Bellevue in New York City all the time. And Bellevue's mentioned in our big book. That was a hospital that there were some doctors that started helping alcoholics later. But I'd be brought in there, and I was sick all the time. I had hepatitis by this time a couple of times. I'd been brought in with pancreatitis and, you know, always locked down in the Nut House, brought in four-point restraint. I may be a small woman, but put some alcohol in me and let me get full of rage, and I'm no picnic, okay? I'll get hurt. I'll get beat up, but, boy, I'll hurt you bad, too. You know, I'll take every shot I can. There's no clean fighting. So when I'm 19 years old, on one of these episodes, I overdosed on alcohol, and I was brought into the hospital, and I was pronounced clinically dead. I hadn't eaten for days, weeks probably. I was just a rail of a girl, and I brought in on this, brought in dead. The people I was with, I was somebody waiting for a liver. I was brought in, and of course, I always had aliases. I was always Jane Doe, or I had street names and stuff like that. And I was brought in, and I was pronounced dead. And I had this experience that I didn't share in AA for a long time because Chris and I were talking about that this morning. I just didn't feel it was right, and I didn't know. And a few years ago, my sponsor said, of course you can share it. And I started sharing it and found out that there's other people in AA and out of AA that have had this experience. So I'm laying there. They're pronouncing me dead. I'm looking down at the table. I'm going, I'm not dead, but those lips that are mine weren't moving. And I'm getting higher and higher, but my body is down there. And I ended up going through that tunnel of light. And some of you may have heard about it. Some of you may not have. This is my experience. I went through that tunnel of light, and it was sort of like I was being sucked into it. And on both sides that were just out of reach of me were all these monsters and demons and stuff, and they were grabbing at me. And I felt scared. I didn't know what was going on, but I kept looking at that light that was at the end of this tunnel, and the fear was taken away. And I'm like zooming through this tunnel, and I get closer and closer, and all of a sudden, I'm there. And there's these beings there, and they didn't look like we looked. They didn't have bodies like we have. I'm not saying they were aliens. They didn't have human bodies. It was sort of like everybody was behind some kind of white gauze or something like that. But I knew they were beings. They just didn't look like we do as humans. And I heard people talking to me, and they welcomed me, and they said, we so love you. And then I was in the presence of God. And the presence of God for me, I was always pretty mad at God. You know, I thought that God had to be this old white guy with a long beard that just hated everybody else. And if you did wrong, buddy, he was going to hurt you. And that was not the experience I had of God. God was not a man, and God was not a woman. God was a being, just a being of just pure love. And I was there, and my life flashed in front of me, all the stuff that I had done. And I was like, oh, my goodness, this is not good, being in the presence of God. And just having that thought, the presence said, yes, it is good. We love you. I so love you. And, you know, everything that you did is forgiven, if you want it to be forgiven. I'm like, yes, I want to be forgiven. And I won't tell you too much about what happened because it was my spiritual experience. But it was a beautiful experience, and I was given the option of whether to come back and be a human or not. And I didn't want to come back to this sad world. And then I met these two beings that said, do you remember us? You agreed a long time ago that we'd come through you and be your children. And I somehow knew what they were talking about. Anyways, I came back to life. I was in a coma for 7 days after that. And then I was locked up in the Nut House again for a while because some stuff. I was locked up for a while. And when I got out of there, I had a lot of time to think in the Nut House, and I thought about all this stuff. Oh, my God, I've been in the presence of God. What do I do now? And I was going to be a better person, and I wasn't going to do that anymore, and I was going to repent, and I was going to treat people good, and I was going to. And the day they released me, I ran across the street to the liquor store, and I got some Thunderbird, and I had to panhandle first, and then I got some Thunderbird, and I drank that, and all those I was going to was gone. You know, I didn't have a program. I didn't have 12 steps. I didn't have a blueprint for living. I didn't have a fellowship of people I could talk to and say, guess what? I've been in the presence of God. What should I do? Can you help me? I just came out and went to the liquor store and got drunk, and that's my story right up until, you know, I got sober in 1983. I ended up having two children. That's a story in itself. I was in, I won't go into the whole story, but I made a decision, well, if I just had kids, if I could just be a mother, this will change. I won't be this way. And I wanted to have a baby so bad. So I was in the hospital with hepatitis for the third or fourth time, and it was I had two types of hepatitis, serum and alcoholic. I had been pronounced one of my times in a nut house. I spent some long times in state hospitals. One of my times I was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic with suicidal homicidal tendencies due to chronic alcoholism. And I'm only 20 years old now, 21 years old. I'm like, what are they talking about? This is just this white judge. I'm just an Indian girl wanting to have a good time, and they're trying to, you know, say this stuff about me. So I'm in the hospital with hepatitis, and one of my brothers comes in. He's got this young kid with him. I'm 21 years old. This kid's 17. I had just been thinking about having a baby. Hey, okay. I'd never met him before, but I made my proposition to him. And he said, yeah, it sounded like a great idea. He'd be willing to impregnate me. So his parents, I got out of the hospital a few weeks later, and his parents were bringing me up on statutory rape charges because he was 17 and I was 21. So I took him to South Carolina and married him. And I, you know, was pregnant with my girl child. And when I had my child and I looked in her eyes, oh, they didn't talk about fetal alcohol syndrome back then. And when I went to the doctor said, you need a little wine to make your blood rich and to relax this growing baby. And I was like, all right, far out. A little wine to me is a little bottle of Mad Dog every night. So that's what I did when I was pregnant. And, you know, I'd sit there pulling on the Mad Dog going, yeah, this is all right. You know, this is okay. I can do this. I'm not really drinking, and I wasn't doing anything else. And I quit smoking because, you know, I want my baby to be healthy. So I have this child, and I look in her eyes, and I saw the face of God. And those of you who have looked into your newborn child's eyes, or any newborn child or animal or whatever, you see the face of God. And I saw the face of God, and I knew I was going to be a good mother. I knew my life of crime and sin was over, and I was going to be a good mother, and I was going to learn how to cook and clean and be a wife, which was not a big aspiration for me, but I was going to learn to do that. And several months later, I was drinking just like I was drinking before. It just didn't work. And I wanted to be a good mother with all my heart. So I left that kid. He was too childish. He was 17 years old, for God's sake. I left that child, told him to, you know, buzz off. I need me a real man. So he left. I moved my child, and I moved over a bar. It made it pretty easy to, you know, I could just run downstairs and run back upstairs. And I met the next victim, and I figured only alcoholics think that we have keen alcoholic minds. You ask any Al-Anon if they think we have keen alcoholic minds. They don't, believe me. So with my keen alcoholic mind thinking, I came up with, well, you know what? I almost had it with that first baby. I almost got it. I was almost there. So I'm going to have me another baby, and then I'll really do it. I will really do it. So I made a proposition to this guy. Hey, listen, I want to have a child. He's like, all right. This is a different guy now. So I married both of them. I never knew. I had four relationships that weren't paid relationships in my life, and I married all four of them because I didn't know what else to do. It seemed like the right thing to do, and if it didn't work out, I could just divorce them. That's my keen alcoholic thinking. So we got married, and life went on. I have these two children that I wanted to be a good mother. I really did. Now, I never whipped my kids, and I never did that kind of stuff to them. My kids always had clothes, and my kids always ate. Now, what they ate was sometimes the same stuff that I ate as a child, and it was good enough for me, you know, some welfare cheese and macaroni or some beans and rice. We ate lots of beans and rice or oatmeal soup. So my kids did eat. They weren't they didn't eat the best, but they did eat. And but other things happened. I abused my children in ways that I didn't know. I'd go to the bar, and I'd have these two kids with me, and I thought this was very motherly of me. I'd put my coat on the floor so they wouldn't have to sit on the bar floor. They could sit on my coat. And I thought that was very motherly. I never left my children with babysitters because only alcoholic losers leave their kids with babysitters. So mine would come to the bar with me. And that's child abuse, because the kind of bars I went to weren't the tinkling piano bars. The bars I went to were ugly, real ugly. And so this man and I decided that we went into the import-export business of certain agricultural products. And then my kids started seeing things like that, things that kids shouldn't be a part of. You know, kids couldn't have anybody over to the house because either mom was going to be drunk and peeing on the floor or there was going to be a big Colombian party happening in the living room. My kids and I had been held hostage with shotguns and Doberman pinchers waiting for to pay for the agricultural products. And that's bad. That's a terrible thing for children to have to live through. And I started feeling guilt, and I started feeling remorse, so I had to drink more and more and more. And the last 8 years of my drinking, my kids would talk about, my kids started off with, "Oh, Mom, you're such a good mother," and then, "We love you, you make the best peanut butter sandwiches in the world." And then my kids started going to public school, and they started looking at me, and how dogs cock their head and look at you, my kids start looking at me like, "Huh?" And then as they got a little older and they're going to other kids' houses and stuff, they started looking at me with scorn and disdain. And they started knowing that there was something wrong with their mother. You know, there was something really wrong. And so the last 8 years of my drinking, my kids begged me to stop drinking. And I told them I would. I was gonna learn to be a good wife and a good mother. I was going to learn to cook and clean and to not run away from home. And I used to run away from home. It was so pathetic, you know, and leave my children. And one day my five-year-old girl comes in the woods. I'm running away again, and she comes out in the woods, and I'm doing this slash on my wrist. And she goes, 5 years old, this girl, and she goes, "Oh, Mom, you're killing yourself again?" And that, you know, it's funny to us now, but it is not funny. It is so sad. You know, my daughter is 38 years old today, and that girl is still in therapy because of me. Now, thank God for therapy, but she is still in therapy because of my behavior. Thank goodness I only hurt myself, you know? Right. So life went on like that. It was just terrible. They promised them I wouldn't drink, so I'd only drink a bottle of Listerine in the morning while I'm getting them off to school, because that's not drinking. And then, of course, I'd go to the liquor store, and it just kept going like that. It just kept going terrible, and my suicide attempts started coming more and more frequently. And then the day came in 1980 that I just knew I couldn't do it anymore. And I couldn't be with this man anymore. It was all his problem. If he wasn't there, I wouldn't be drinking like that. So I made a decision that we were going to dig up our money and split our money, and he could go his way, and I'm going my way. What I did with my money is I went to a house building school, and I bought a little parcel of land, and I bought some lumber. So I went to this home building school, and I made myself stay sober during the day while I'm learning to use tools and learning to build and stuff, and then at night I'd get, you know, totally wasted. And I went to this home building school, and I started building this little house for my kids and I. And one day, this guy, Michael, came. He was there, and I asked him to go to the liquor store and get me something. He was kind of a useless guy. He couldn't get up on the roof or do this or do that, but he could go to the liquor store. So I sent him to the liquor store, and he didn't come back in time. Now, I'm up on the roof with putting the roof on, and I have a roofing hammer. And if y'all know what a roofing hammer looks like, it looks like a hatchet. It looks like a scalping hatchet. Now, you get a drunken Indian up on a roof with a scalping hatchet, and you have this man come back that's been gone for 2 hours. And I jumped off the roof, and I tried to take his scalp. I did a war scream on the way down. And I tried to take his scalp. I wasn't really probably going, I don't know. But my brother kicked me off, and that guy left, and he said our marriage was over, fine, whatever. And he left, and shortly after that, it was a few days later, I'm sitting in the backwoods there. I'm way out in the woods by now. I couldn't be around other people because I am a psycho, okay? I can't be around other people. I'd forget to wear clothes half the time, but I'd always have my knife with me, and I was like a psycho. I needed to be in the state hospital, but, you know, nobody could find me to put me there. So I'm living out in the woods. I go to the back of the yard. My kids are at school. I put the shotgun in my mouth. I can't do it anymore. I'm going to smoke the shotgun. I can't do it anymore. I'm a failure. I'm a total loser. I ruined my children's life. I'm just a loser. So I've got the shotgun in my mouth and my toes on the trigger, and I had this little moment of clarity about my kids getting off the school bus. I've already made their life pure hell. You know, I've already brought them down the toilet bowl. And they're going to come home, and Mom's going to be dead. And I knew I couldn't do that. I knew, even in my most selfishness, that I couldn't do that to my children. So I said those words that so many of us said. I said, "God, help me." That's all I said. "God, help me." But I didn't just say it. I meant it. I said it from my heart. I said, "God, help me." And it was wintertime, and I lived up in the Northeast then, and hawks migrate that time of the year. They were gone. But I said that prayer, and I looked up, and there was a hawk circling over me. And the hawk circled down low. And in our culture, what that means is that your prayer's been answered, and that hawk or that eagle is going to take your prayer up to the Creator. So I knew my prayer had been answered, and I didn't know how, but I knew my prayer had been answered. So I obviously didn't pull the trigger, and I went in the house, and a few months later, I got to tell you, that house didn't have any windows in it. It had plywood. It didn't have a door. It had plywood. It didn't have indoor plumbing, and there was no insulation or no furniture. We slept on sheetrock. So I go back into my castle, you know, and hey, my grandma had a dirt floor. We're not having a dirt floor, kids. So I go in there, and several months later, I was brought to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous through a whole series of events. I'd never even heard of it, you know, but I was brought here, and that's God working in my life. That was just God working in my life. So I'm brought to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I first got here, and I'm looking around. The guy, I hadn't eaten for a few days, and the kids were at their grandparents' because there was no food in the house, and I had no visible means of support. I had no invisible means of support. And there was no food. The only heat we had was a wood stove, and I had cleared the land of that little castle I built with a bow saw. And I had some trees that had seasoned a little bit, but mostly I was cutting down green trees, burning them in the wood stove, so we had big chimney fires every day and all sorts of alcoholic excitement. So my kids, I sent them to their grandmother's house. We had no phone, no toilet, nothing like that. They went to their grandma's house, and I'm staying there with no food, and hey, my relatives ate outside and ate, you know, roots and barks and berries, so I'm outside looking around for stuff to eat and didn't find much. But I was brought to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had been in the woods for so long that I was just astounded when this series of events happened, that this person came to my house. Nobody came to my house. My house, I told you, I built it, and I had no fear. I was a strong woman. I had no fear. Nothing scares me. I had a loaded shotgun with me all the time, and I had a big knife on me all the time, and I built my bed 8 feet off the floor in the rafters with a ladder that I could pull up, and I built my house with windows and every crucial point that my shotgun could be out of that window in a heartbeat. So if I missed you with the shotgun and you came in and you didn't know that I was up there, you were dead. You know, so I had it all worked out. Well, the real reason I had my bed up 8 feet off the floor is because if your bed's 8 feet off the floor, the end of the bed monster can't get you. Okay? And I had three closets, and there were no closets on the closet doors, because if you don't have closet doors, the closet monster can't get you. I never told anybody the truth about that until I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm brought to the rooms of AA, and I'm weirded out of my mind. I haven't been around people for a long time. And I come here, and all I see at that time, there wasn't as many women. This is 1981. There wasn't that many women. It was all these white guys, and it was I just knew everybody, you know, was Christian, and they were just going to try to take away my religion and try to ruin my life. Hello, what life? You know, I had no life. But I kept coming to meetings, and I heard the laughter, and that laughter meant so much to me. And I was trying to figure out who was in charge here, and I was trying to figure out all this stuff. And one day, one of the people sat next to me said, you know, we're not going to ask you to leave. You can keep coming to meetings. But I saw you bite that guy earlier in the meeting, and that is not allowed. We are not allowed to bite people in the meetings. And I said, you don't understand. He grabbed my butt. And he said, well, we'll talk to him about that, but you're not allowed to bite him. So I would sit by myself at meetings, and I wouldn't share anything. And all sorts of stuff started happening, and it was pretty weird. AA was pretty weird for me, but I knew there was nowhere else to go, and I kept coming. Early on, I didn't have any job skills, so someone suggested that someone in an AA meeting said, why don't you go to the local college, which was like 30 miles away, and sign up and take some college courses. And I said, no, college is for losers. You know, I'm not going to college. Only losers go to college. Come on, I've met those effete snobs. And it was, it's better than what you're doing. So I went to the college, and the man that, wonderful man, Mr. Evans, ran the affirmative action office as a minority student. He grabbed me and brought me into the affirmative action office, and he helped me. He walked me through my college years. I ended up going for 5 years and getting several degrees. And now, let me tell you, for those of you folks who deal with people when you're sponsoring newcomers, they go, oh, I can't go to all those meetings. I'm a busy person. This is what happened for me. I was a single mother with two kids. I was building my house by myself on weekends, cutting my own cordwood. I needed 5 or 6 cord wood a year. I was going to two AA meetings every single day. I was going to working construction 30 hours a week and taken 12 semester hours of college every semester. So when people go, oh, I can't, I got to stay home and watch 24 that night. Well, you know, come on. What's more important, your soul and your life, or staying home watching TV, or doing something? So I kept doing that, and my recovery has been very, very slow. I told you that I changed my sobriety date because of outside issues, and I did change that sobriety date. And when I was very newly sober, I was just broker than broke. I was just so broke. And this guy called me up, and my mom had got me a telephone. This guy called me up, and he said, I needed $600 to pay the taxes from this house. So this guy called me up, and he said, listen, a bunch of lawyers and doctors are getting together, and they need a dancer, and I thought of you. And I'm like, oh, boy, how much? And he goes, $600. I said, no touching, no touching. And I said, $600. I said, okay, maybe I'll do that. I said, wow. I get off the phone. I said, let me call you back. I get off the phone. I said, this is a God thing. I need $600. This guy is calling me. All I have to do is get naked. Big deal. $600. And then instantly, the thought came into my mind. All I have to do is get naked and disrespect myself once again. I called him back. I said, no, thank you. God's in my life. And God told me, stand up, woman. You know, don't do that anymore. And that was the, I didn't. And a few weeks later, somebody that I hadn't seen in years and years that owed me money came and paid me money they owed me, and it was $600. You know, it was just, it was a wild thing. I got involved in alcoholics right from the very beginning. I jumped into AA. I jumped into service work. I got a sponsor. The first sponsor I had was a man because I didn't like women. Women were, come on, I can't even use a 16-pound maul. Don't know how to use a gun. Please, you know, why am I going to tell a woman? And we have nothing in common. So I had a guy for a sponsor, and he wanted me to start looking within and making changes and taking the steps. So I got naked, and that was the end of him trying to get me to do the steps, you know. And thank you, God, that guy did not go out. He didn't. He was a nice man. He was really a nice man. And he said no, he didn't want to sponsor me, but I kept insisting, he kept insisting. Come on, gals, you know how it is when we reel one of those guys in. They don't have a chance. So he didn't end up going out, but I did. And after that, I learned that men stick with men and women stick with women for that very, very reason. He didn't want to do that. He was not a 13-stepper. He was a good man, but he didn't have a chance. You know, he just didn't have a chance. So I got me a woman sponsor, and we began working the steps. And that woman could only teach me what she had been taught. And the area where I got sober, they were not strong, big book sobriety. They were, oh, meeting makers make it. And they were, put the plug in the jug, you'll be okay. Nah, you don't need to rush into those steps. I do a step a year, you know, that kind of stuff. And that's all I knew, so it sounded good to me. And then I wasn't getting better. I was not doing a lot of the stuff I had done before, and I wasn't drinking, and I wasn't in the import-export anymore, and I wasn't getting naked anymore, except in the bathtub. But inside, I still wanted to die. Things were still really bad. So I got a woman sponsor. I started going to. I had a woman sponsor. I got another woman sponsor, and I started going to some different meetings. Meetings where they came out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Meetings where they said it's about you. You don't like the way you feel. You need to change. Meetings that they talked about action. And did somebody go take care of that baby? About action, being of service to others, and being a useful woman. And so I started doing that, and I was one of the first women that spoke in the Connecticut State Prison, maximum security prison. I was asked to go in there. I said, well, I've never been in a maximum security prison, and these two old-timer guys said, yeah, you probably dated half the guys in there, and they need women to come in that have a strong AA message because you're their mother, their daughter, their girlfriend, their wife, whatever, and they need to hear that. So I loved it. I went in there, and I started doing prison commitment then, and I got a two-year commitment at a local county jail, and I couldn't go to the state hospital and put on a meeting for a long time because I'd been locked in so many state hospitals. I just knew that if I walked in, they weren't letting me out. But when, and I thought that as soon as I walked in and started around my peers, that I'd start acting just like them again. But when I was about 4 years sober, I was able to start going to the state hospital and doing a meeting as well. And getting involved in these steps, you know, just transformed my life. My sponsor and I went through the book, and where there was a step, we took it. We read the book from the beginning. Where there was a step, we took it. And where there was a prayer, we took it. Now, for any of you who haven't done a fourth step, I heard Norm say the other night that he was told to start reading chapter 5, and that's what I was told at first in AA, too. Just start in chapter 5. And then I found out from other people in AA, well, if you're going to take algebra or science or anything like that, you don't start on chapter 5. You start on chapter page 1, because how are you going to add, you know, build up on all this? So I started in the beginning of the book and went through the steps and found out that there are so many prayers in this book. You know, just so many prayers. Coming to that third step, having made a decision that I was going to go on with the rest of this program, coming to that third step, there's no amen on that third step prayer. I don't know if you've noticed that, but there is no amen. So what I was taught is that we take that third step prayer when we're ready to go on with the program with our sponsor. We come to that third step prayer. There's no amen. From there, right until through and including step 11, we are under the blanket or the umbrella of prayer. And it is not a punishment that I had to do a fourth step and talk about all that stuff. It was a gift that God so loves me that he's given me the opportunity to say all the things I've done. And not only that, he gives me the opportunity to come in front of people and tell you, I used to be a loser. I used to be a fall down woman. And I am a stand up spiritual warrior today by the grace of God. I am a stand up spiritual warrior. I'm an awake member of Alcoholics Anonymous, an awake member, because of the steps in this book and being of use to others and asking God for help in the morning. I met my husband, Mark, in Alcoholics Anonymous. We've been married for a long time. I can't remember dates. Long time. And my daughter gave me a plaque. Let me picture it. Okay, 1992. We've been married since 1992. And I was at a point that when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I really hated everybody equally. I didn't know my affectional preference. I didn't know anything. I was just so confused. And by the time I reached the point that Mark and I met each other, I was done with men, I'll tell you that. Because I had even met a guy in AA that, you know, please. I was just so done with men. And I turned that over to God. Before that, I'd say, God, I'm turning everything over to you except my sex life. I don't want any dweebs, please. You know, I better work, do that one myself. And I have a bad picker, a real bad picker. So I kept ending up with people that I picked. So I turned that over to God, and I said, God, if you're ready for me to have a relationship, fine. If you're not, that's okay, too. I'd reached that point. I was about 4 years sober. I was okay with that. And then God brought Mark and I together. And our relationship is successful because we put God first in our life and in our marriage. We put God in AA first. Then I put Mark before me, and he puts me before him. And we love Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's given me everything in my life. I'm just not the same person. I've been reborn. I can freely talk about that because my dark past in God's hands can help other people. I sponsored Dolores for 6 years. I don't currently sponsor, but I did sponsor for 6 years. And the women that come to me and ask me for help usually aren't the daiquiri drinkers. They're usually the women that are like I was. They're the women that just don't feel any hope, and they don't know where to go. I didn't know what to do. I just knew that I was just going to burn in hell forever, so whatever. And I don't feel that way today. I know that I have a place, and I know what God wants me to do. And when I go to bed at night, I say, God, did I do okay today? Did I do your work well? Are you proud of me? It doesn't matter what you think of me. It doesn't matter what somebody else thinks of me, but it really matters what God thinks of me, and I try to conduct myself in that way. I spend a lot of time praying and a lot of time meditating, and I teach the gals that I sponsor that, and they're all real strong AA too. I thought that, oh, well, if I get real spiritual and turn my life over to God, I'm never going to have sex again. There'll be never fun again, and that's just not the truth, you know. Susan read this morning, God wants us be happy, joyous, and free. We are not a glum lot. And in my culture, Indian culture, sex is something we can talk about and joke about and have fun about and mix my culture with AA and with Cajuns and, you know, with other people. And we do want to have fun. We do want to have a good time. But my fun today is not at the expense of somebody else. My fun used to be at the expense of other people, whether it was my children. And my fun today is that I find nothing more fun than seeing the light turn on in somebody's eyes, helping some woman out of hell that she's created and watching the light come on in her eyes. And, buddy, that's a good deal. And, you know, if I was to die today and return to spirit, I'm not putting my bid in, God. But if I was, it would be okay because I don't hate anybody and nobody hates me and I am at total peace inside myself. And that is a gift given to me by Alcoholics Anonymous and by willing to stand up and keep AA strong and teach out of this big book and to tell stories from this book and to share my experience with others. And it, you know, it's just it's a great life. It really is. It's a wonderful life. I'm going to end with a prayer that I always end with. O great spirit, whose voice we hear in the wind, whose breath gives life to all the world, hear me. I am small and weak. I need your strength and wisdom. Let me walk in beauty and make my eyes ever behold the red and purple sunset. Make my hands respect the things you have made. Make my ears sharp to hear your voice. And make my voice only speak your words, Lord. Make me wise so that I may better understand the things you taught my people. Let me learn the lessons you have hidden in every leaf and rock. I seek strength, not to be greater than my brother and sister, but to fight my greatest enemy, myself. Make me ready to come to you with clean hands and straight eyes so when life fades as the fading sunset, my spirit may come to you without shame. May your way be blessed with a unifying power of the great Holy Spirit. And in our culture, we don't say goodbye. We say until we meet again. Dona Dada, go hai. Bless you.